WKAR's current state for Tuesday. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are glad you could join us. Coming up this hour, pipelines are a hot topic in our state, and we are going to have a long, productive discussion about pipelines. One of them, the oil pipeline that runs through the Mackinac Straits, that has generated an awful lot of concern lately, especially in the wake of the University of Michigan study that just came out in a video that actually details various spill scenarios, pipeline rupture scenarios, as well as a proposed natural gas pipeline, 150 miles of which would run through Michigan. Enbridge, the oil transport giant out of Canada, is involved in both projects. Later this hour, Beth Wallace of the Pipeline Safety Trust will give her take on how best to move forward on this. Lots more coming up this hour. At the top of our program, the sign on the vacant church building on Pleasant Grove in South Lansing says Friendship Baptist, but in recent months, relations between two groups within the congregation have been anything but friendly. The church has been shut down more than a month in a bitter dispute between two factions battling for control. In June, one side barricaded the doors, denying entry to the other. What was once a united congregation has been holding services in two separate locations. The city of Lansing is trying to mediate the conflict. Joining us now to explain is Bishop David Maxwell, a respected member of the clergy and a director of the City of Lansing's Office of Community and Faith-Based Initiatives. Bishop Maxwell, welcome to Current State.
I'm glad to be here.
But what are the roots of this dispute for our listeners who maybe haven't paid real close attention to this? What is this about, and how far back does it go?
Well, it goes back some ways, at least to my knowledge, 7 years ago. It is not a theological dispute where you have two factions that have a different biblical interpretation. It is what I would consider an administrative or a constitutional disagreement that goes back about 7 years.
And what happened 7 years ago?
It appears that there was two constitutions, the 1984 Constitution and then a revised Constitution of 2007. The revised Constitution of 2007 altered and gave more strength to the ability of the church to manage and to give oversight of the pastor. And that was somewhat in conflict with one side, one segment of the church. And there's been some controversy as to whether the 2007 Constitution actually supplanted the 1984 Constitution. And so one side ostensibly decides to go by the 1984 Constitution, and the other side determined to go by the 2007 Constitution.
To the point where today you have two different congregations holding separate services?
Well, I would like to say two different iterations or expressions of one congregation. Friendship Baptist Church is one church, and it has been commonplace to say two different congregations, but in actuality, the people of Friendship are essentially one. It is a matter of who controls the apparatus, the government, and the physical building. What governmental body within that one church controls that? So you have two governments, so to speak, two trustee boards, two deacon boards that are essentially split. And then you have the membership aligning themselves behind which governmental expression that they think is legitimate and right.
Did the two sides coexist peacefully here for any part of this 7 year period? I mean, can we assume they were talking to each other, communicating, trying to work this out?
Yeah, for the most part, they coexisted together peacefully in the same building. I think they went into about 3 or 4 years ago. 4 years ago, they went into two separate services. At 8:30, and then there was the 10:30 congregation or the 10:30 service. The city's involvement has simply been by request of either both or one of the sides to come in and mediate. and to use our good offices. And of course, the city's involvement has been whenever there is a disruption of the peace, and our safety protectors, the LPD, has been called in. We, of course, responded in that way. But basically, it has been somewhat peaceful. There has been a lot of calls to the Lansing Police Department over these 7 years, but nothing to the extent that erupted in the month of May.
Well, you probably know more about this than just about anybody. I mean, how long have you been involved in this process?
We have been involved from day one, or at least 7 years ago, we were involved.
And what happened in May, exactly?
What happened in May, one governmental side decided that they had exhausted all avenues of reconciliation or all avenues of trying to resolve the difference. And it just came to a head, so to speak, in which one side just declared that enough is enough, quoting the words of one of the trustees, and they decided to take more aggressive measures to essentially stop one side from actually utilizing the building.
Mm. And what kind of approach are you taking right now as a mediator? Where are you right now as far as your involvement goes? What are you trying to get done?
Well, first and foremost, my job is to give counsel from a perspective to the mayor, and to give counsel to, when asked, the LPD department in relationship to religious matters and some of the polity and culture that's going on. We, as a mediator, we do not have a standing mediatorial role with that church. We have been asked on several occasions, and when there is one side feels that they are not being properly treated by city officials or whatever, they will call my office to register that complaint and try to get a word to the mayor or to the police chief or to the powers that be. But there is no standing mediation that is in place. We are operating basically at the request of the members of Friendship Baptist Church.
Hmm. Our guest here today on Current State, Bishop David Maxwell, who is serving as a mediator between the two sides at the divided Friendship Baptist Church here in Lansing. You suggested a minute ago that in May, one faction here basically abandoned the process. Where is the other faction? Are they more willing to keep this process alive, or has this really completely broken down?
Well, in order not to invalidate my impartiality and to be a true mediator, I'd rather not say whether one side has abandoned or is more conciliatory than the other side. The issues remain there, and I would hope in the heart of hearts of all parties involved that it is their desire to have one united Friendship Baptist Church. But of course, in any kind of dispute, there are sides and factions. One will tend to be more hardened and entrenched in a position than the other. That's a natural occurrence, but I don't think it serves any great purpose towards mediation, and I definitely think it would compromise my position if called upon. And might I add, you know, the city, we're not trying to inject ourselves into that theater. We're not trying to impose ourselves. We were called. They ask us, and of course, whenever there is a public safety issue, then the city of Lansing will respond.
You've said, though, that mediation has broken down. The communication has stopped. Are you making an effort to resuscitate that?
No, we're not making an effort per se. If they call upon us, if we are asked to become a mediator or to extend our mediatorial behavior, we will. But at this particular time, there is no communication in the last week from either side regarding mediation. There has been, of course, communication regarding some complaints and some issues that they might be having in conjunction with the building being red tagged.
The church itself needs to be inspected by fire inspectors, from what I understand.
Yes.
And what's stopping that process? What is stopping the building from being inspected by the fire marshal?
Well, of course, the building was barricaded. Alarms and doors were disarmed, which makes it unsafe for people to gather. And that is a major, major facility. And you cannot have 300, 400, 500, 600 people in it and one exit door. That would be dereliction of the city's responsibilities to maintain a safe environment. So the city had to, and the fire marshal properly had to close that building until those barricades were taken down.
Is one side or the other standing in the way of the fire inspection?
The city has not determined which is the governmental authority in that building.
Okay.
So what our position is that we will inspect the building once they call us to inspect. We do have two recognizable governmental authorities in that building, and that has been the major problem. We don't know. If they don't know, we definitely don't know who's the governmental authority. So our position is to respect both sides, and we would need both sides to call us so that we can get in there, properly do what needs to be done. There are some legal things involved in reopening a building and some responsibilities, and we need to make sure that the responsible parties are there when we inspect that building.
Do you feel this is the end of the Friendship Baptist Church?
I am an eternal optimist. I am a man of faith, and I believe that there's always a possibility. It is very, very dark now, but it is possible, and I would not go as far to say this is the end. Definitely not the end of Friendship Baptist Church. There has to be some type of iteration of the Friendship Baptist Church that comes out of this, but by faith and my positive outlook that there will be some type of reconciliation.
You're on the city payroll, correct, to some extent?
Yes.
There have been people who have asked aloud, quite a few, it seems, what is the city, as a governmental entity, why is the city involved in this? Beyond the issue with the fire department and the fire inspection here, how do you respond to that? To a lot of people, this seems like a non-governmental incident that really doesn't merit the government's involvement.
Well, we're not involved. We understand the separation of state. We understand the ecclesiastical doctrines, and the city is not involved in any way that violates that. But we are involved when you get an excessive amount of calls to the Lansing Police Department, then they involve the city. We are involved when our resources have to be committed to keep the peace. And we are involved because they ask the mayor's office to mediate. We didn't ask them, they ask us.
Okay.
And whenever there is an ongoing conflict in the community, I think it would be wise and prudent of any governmental unit to try to use their good office to kind of solve that. And there was indeed an ongoing dispute that can be verified by a number of police calls. So that's our involvement. We're not trying to impose ourselves. We were asked, and in addition to being asked, we were called by 911.
You know, quite a few members of the outside community view this situation as almost tragically comical. You've got a church with Friendship in the name. It almost seems as if no one involved on either side of this dispute is doing themselves any favors by what has transpired here.
Yes, it is antithetical to the core values of the church. It's antithetical to the name Friendship. And to expand a little further on your previous question about involvement, Friendship has always been involved with the city. It has always been involved. It is a community church, and many of its members are recognizable and prevalent citizens within the community. There have been outreach programs. There have been food drives. There have been other social programs extended from that church. So the relationship with Friendship is not a closed relationship. They are a community church. And I think that was the natural course because of our previous relationship in working with Friendship in a plethora of social and humanitarian needs. we had a natural relationship. The mayor's office, Mayor Bonero, and myself, it was just a natural relationship. So we understand why naturally they would ask the mayor and this office to use their influence to try to bring things together. And yes, it is indeed tragic. It is comical. It is embarrassing. It is unfortunate. And it is a drain on time. It is a drain on resources. It's a drain on energy. And it is not the picture that we want to project. No one wants to project.
We've been discussing Lansing's Friendship Baptist Church and the crossroads it is at. Our guest has been Bishop David Maxwell, Director of the Office of Community and Faith-Based Initiatives with the City of Lansing. Good luck, Bishop Dave.
All right. Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us here on Tuesday, the midway point of July, July 15th indeed. Pipelines have been a hot topic in Michigan in recent years. Very recent developments suggest the issue is intensifying. Canada's Enbridge is part of a proposal to install about 600 miles of new interstate natural gas pipelines. About 150 miles of those pipelines would run through Michigan. Besides arousing environmental concerns over a possible pipeline rupture, the proposal affects homeowners whose properties were not long ago previously disrupted by another Enbridge project. Concerns have also grown recently about the company's 61-year-old oil pipeline that runs through the Straits of Mackinac. Last week, a University of Michigan study explored several gloomy scenarios if that line broke. These concerns are all, of course, in the wake of 2010's oil pipeline rupture near Marshall, the country's largest inland oil spill. For its perspective on these most recent developments, we welcome a board member of a group that promotes pipeline safety, quote, through education, advocacy, increased access to information and partnerships, unquote. The group is the Pipeline Safety Trust. Beth Wallace is also a consultant to environmental groups on pipeline safety issues. Beth Wallace, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more. Let's start with the natural gas pipeline proposal here. Tell us more about that. How far along is this proposal?
Sure. It's Energy Transfer. It's called E.T. Rover Pipeline. It runs from about Pennsylvania through Ohio, Michigan, and then back into Canada. It's very much an export pipeline. It's very, very at the beginning of the process, they have barely even filed paperwork with the Energy Regulatory Agency, FERC, who will be overseeing their application. So we have a year, maybe two, of the application process, which will have public comment periods, hearings, and opportunities for landowners to voice opposition.
And FERC will clarify, Federal Energy. You referred to FERC,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it's a federal agency that oversees natural gas pipelines.
Okay, very good. And this is an export pipeline. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that the gas going through it will not be consumed by...
That's actually a question up in the air. There's a couple diversion points, two of which are in Michigan, possibly one in Ohio, where there will be a product either being refined of some sort or consumed, very little, but most of it is going right back into Canada.
And a 600-mile pipeline altogether, about a quarter of it running through Michigan. Tell us more about E.T. Rover and Enbridge here and their collaboration.
Sure. The collaboration actually began a year ago when Energy Transfer had a natural gas pipeline that fed Michigan's market with gas. It was called Trunkline Pipeline, and they filed application with the federal agency FERC to have it decommissioned so Enbridge could take over and push oil south. So they decommissioned that pipeline, and Enbridge is now acquiring that pipeline to push oil south. Now, the original pipeline fed Michigan with gas, and the governor and several senators came out in opposition saying, you're removing a huge source of gas for the state of Michigan, and Energy Transfer came back and said, no, you guys have an oversupply. It's fine. We can shut down this pipeline and turn it into an oil pipeline. That's okay. And then they said this to FERC, and FERC went along with it. Now, a year later, they're coming back to FERC and saying Michigan actually does not have enough gas in the market, and we need to build a brand new pipeline. So there's a controversy there and something that definitely needs to be sorted out. And if I were a landowner facing a third, even maybe a fourth pipeline on my property, I would be fuming about this concept.
But Enbridge and E.T. Rover are justifying this project by saying that more natural gas needs to be into the system in Michigan and in these other areas.
And,
is that,
and exported,
it's a supply.
Yeah.
It's a, okay.
And so the big controversy here is that they're saying it's a public necessity, a public need now. But a year ago, they were saying it's not a public necessity. It's not a public
just
need.
Just 1 year ago?
Yes. And so that they're acquiring land. That's how they obtain eminent domain. It's a land grab for private private companies. They take public land or private land from landowners, and they say it's for the public necessity. Now, the question here, is it actually for public necessity or is it for private profit?
Well, how will local residents be affected then?
They are the ones that are taking all the risks. So their land is being taken, again, from an energy company for private profit and ripped up. I'm talking hundreds of trees in some cases. I would talk to many landowners who just went through the Enbridge Line 6B replacement expansion, and they had 900 trees knocked down, huge amounts of property torn up. They're still going through restoration, and they just got this letter for a brand new pipeline, so they could be going through the entire process again. And this is not a small pipeline. This is a 42-inch pipeline in most places, which is a huge natural gas pipeline. If there were to ever be any kind of leak or explosion, it would be an amazing catastrophe for a landowner, for communities. And so there's just some very heavy questions for FERC on how well they're paying attention to Energy Transfer's arguments.
Is your group suggesting that the existing network, the existing pipeline infrastructure is adequate?
That's, you know, I think there's some game playing here. I don't think that this is a pipeline that's going to benefit the state of Michigan or Ohio. I think this is mostly an export pipeline that's going back into Canada.
And rupture is the main risk here, correct?
Oh, definitely. So, and it'll be right next to oil pipelines that are already in operation. So what is the risk there? Obviously, people are losing land.
Where does the responsibility for the regulatory and safety controls of the pipeline break down in terms of federal, state, local government entities? Is there much local communities can do?
You can do stuff at the county level. You know, the zoning can have an impact on how this pipeline gets in place. So there is opportunity for very local, but mostly the way this is going to be permitted and the eminent domain issue is at a federal level with FERC. They will issue whether this is for public necessity or not.
Many millions of people rely on oil and natural gas for all kinds of important uses, to heat their homes, to drive their cars. In general, Beth, how should oil and gas get from where it's drilled to where it's needed, if not through pipelines?
Oh, I'm not advocating against pipelines. It's very much a safe way to transport product. My issue is this a public necessity? Is this needed? And is this the direction Michigan, Ohio should be going? Or should we be focusing on producing very local energy, renewable energy? Where does this end, I guess, is my point. This is going to be, again, the third or fourth pipeline on people's property. And the question is this actually a necessity for Michigan? Is this what we need? And I would say even for the nation, if FERC really looks at what this pipeline is doing, it is exporting into Sarnia.
Let's move up to the Mackinac Straits here now. A video animation released last week from the University of Michigan models what would happen if there were a leak in the pipeline underneath the straits. You co-authored a report on the pipeline back in 2012 about its potential hazards. How serious is this situation in your view?
I think it's incredibly serious, and it's not just serious for the crossing at the Straits of Mackinac. The entire pipeline is 61 years old. The line on land has had many issues, including a major explosion in Crystal Falls. There's a oil leak that eventually they had to catch on fire because it caused a gas bloom. So this pipeline has had a history of failure. And how is Enbridge maintaining it? Why aren't they not being transparent with the public? People are asking very thoughtful questions. They're very well educated at this point, and the transparency is just non-existent.
Enbridge claims that they monitor the pipeline in ways that they have not monitored it in the past, that it is fit for service. They point to an incident-free record here.
Mm-hmm.
How is the public supposed to put that in context here?
Well, I mean, just look at the facts. There's a great resource that's actually going live in the next couple of days. It's called Oil and Water Don't Mix, and it gives Enbridge's history in the region on the Lakehead system, and you can see that they have had a history of failure. Right after the Kalamazoo River oil spill, the National Transportation Safety Board came out with a scathing report on Enbridge's history and their inability to listen to regulators on how they should be improving their system. And so I think the facts speak for themselves, and they can tout their safety record as much as they want, but when they're not willing to give actual detail and the integrity of the pipeline, it makes people wonder and question, and I'm happy that that's happening.
In the Crystal Falls incident you referred to, is that a part of the line that runs through through the Straits?
Yes, Line 5 runs in the Upper Peninsula through the Straits and the Lower Peninsula and out into Sarnia. It's an export pipeline. And Crystal Falls, it happened in 1999. It was, I think, 36,000 gallons that spilled, caused a gas plume in a low wetland area, and they decided to ignite it. It burned for several hours, and that was the only way they could control that spill. There's also, through FOIA information for this pipeline, we know that there are thousands of anomalies. These are cracks, dents on this pipeline. Where are they located? How are they being monitored? How are they being fixed? None of this information Enbridge is being transparent about. And I was also with the National Wildlife Federation when they did a dive on this pipeline at the Straits of Mackinac last summer, and we discovered that there's so much growth on the pipeline. How are they able to do external inspections when there's so much growth? There's also original brackets that have rusted away, which indicates that there's corrosion, and the pipeline actually suspends in a lot of locations. How is it being anchored down? Is it being anchored down?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of questions, and they're just not being forthcoming.
If people want to learn more, if our listeners want to learn more about this issue, where should they go?
They should go to the, I host a blog or a journal. It's called surfgreatlakes.org. There's also a great blog called the Line 6B Citizens blog. And obviously the Pipeline Safety Trust has all of this information on their website.
Beth Wallace has been our guest. She is a consultant to environmental groups on pipeline safety issues and serves on the board of the Pipeline Safety Trust. Beth Wallace, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. A recent study indicates that the more familiar young children are with the brand names of less healthy foods, the more likely they are to be overweight or obese. And Current State's Melissa Benmark joins us now with more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. I talked to an MSU professor that was part of the research team on the study. Anna McAllister is an assistant professor of advertising and public relations. And this study is interesting for several reasons, not the least of which is how you get a bunch of 3 to 5 year olds to express themselves on a bunch of verbally kind of out of their league things like brand identification. So what we did, we started out to talk about what exactly they set out to measure in the study.
We measured children's knowledge of brands that offer soda, fast food, candy, sugar breakfast cereals, and tortilla chips as well. And so all of those are brands that typically their products are high in salt, fat, and sugar. So we assessed the children's knowledge of these brands and then looked at the relationship between their familiarity with the brands and their BMI, or body mass index.
And what did you find?
What we found was that the children who know most about those brands and are most familiar with those brands have higher BMIs than children who know less about the brands. And another way of looking at that, we ran an analysis a slightly different way, and what we found was that children who know most about these brands are more likely to fall into categories of being overweight or obese versus being normal healthy weight.
So what is the takeaway from that, do you think, in terms of, is more study needed, or is there, you know, is there a connection that you see directly between BMI and knowledge of brands, especially through their logos?
Sure. So to answer your question about the takeaway, one other thing I need to mention is that we did also measure children's physical activity. Okay, we looked at how active they were during the week, and in our first study, we found that despite there being a relationship between their brand awareness and their BMI, that that could be offset by physical activity. We ran the study again. It was almost identical to the first time round. It was again looking at the relationship between brand awareness and BMI. And we again looked at physical activity. But in the second study, we found consistently that relationship between brand knowledge and BMI. However, in the second study, physical activity did nothing to offset the relationship. So the takeaway message is that the relationship between a child's brand knowledge and their BMI, or another way of looking at it, is their overweight or obesity status, is very strong. And there are times when maybe it looks like physical activity could offset that. And then there's other times when physical activity is doing nothing to resolve the issue. And to us, we think that's very important, because I think sometimes physical activity, of course we want to encourage it, but I think sometimes physical activity is seen as a cure-all. Right. Even as adults, we say, well, I'll eat Burger King for dinner, but I'm going to go to the gym tomorrow. And to us, our results seem to be sort of a warning sign that this may be a dangerous way of thinking about lifestyle choices.
I remember when we were kids, we could always sing the words to the ads for food, you know, the bologna ad and that kind of thing. And I wondered if there was, you mentioned when I was reading up on this, that you also looked at not just logos, but also cartoon characters associated with various types of food. Do you have a sense that there's a particularly, that there's a hierarchy of, you know, catchy words, or cartoon characters rank higher than just a regular logo? Is there a sense that there's something that's more attractive to a young child, you know, 3 to 5 in this case?
Well, in our study, we didn't look at, we didn't get down to the nitty gritty of saying, okay, is it the character that's important, or is it the color that's important, the color of the logo? We didn't do that in the study. So I couldn't answer that with strong statistical evidence. What I can tell you, though, is that in more than a decade of working with preschool kids, what I've become very familiar with is their sense of what is for them. Okay, so often little girls will think that if it's pink, it's for them, and boys think that if it's blue in color, it's for them. Likewise, if it has a cartoon character on it, it's for them. Okay, and this is precisely what we saw decades ago with the Joe Camel cigarettes, right? Was that kids knew it and paid attention to it because there was a character associated with it.
Sort of one of my pastimes is reading some of the foodie blogs. And one thing I notice that's a very common thread in food writing is there's always someone saying, when I was a little kid, we never had X and my friends had X. And most of the time it's my mom made us whole wheat bread and carrot muffins, and my friend had Oreos in the lunch and I wanted Oreos. There's this common thread of envy of what other kids have. But I mean, to some extent, isn't envy kind of the whole point of advertising?
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting is that a few years ago we ran a study with the same co-author, Bettina Cornwell. We ran a study where we looked at children's familiarity with brands, and then we looked at how they use those brands as social symbols. Okay, this is something that in the marketing literature we refer to as brand symbolism understanding. Just as an adult might judge or think about another adult based on the brands they wear and they use, right? Someone who wears a Rolex, maybe I think they're wealthy or successful or arrogant, whatever you want to attach to that, okay? We found that we asked young children questions like, instead of saying popular because they don't know what that means, we would say things like, well, if another child has this brand, will he have lots of friends or not many friends or somewhere in between? And we found that children as young as three, about 30% of the children in our sample would consistently make judgments, as opposed to saying like, well, I don't know, or I haven't met him. They would say, oh yeah, he'll be really cool if he eats McDonald's, or no, he'll be a loser because he's fat. These were the types of comments that came out from roughly 30% of the children in that study. So yeah, I think that advertising does work in a way that allows us to form impressions based on brand usage.
That's kind of an interesting point you bring up, that with working kids 3 to 5, you can't exactly have them write out a survey. So what did you do in the study? Did you tape record them? How did you deal with the language gap, essentially?
You're right. It is very difficult to work with children because of that language barrier. What we do in most of the studies that I run is we do a language assessment with children. It's a standardized language assessment that's typically used by developmental psychologists to see if children are at age level in terms of their understanding of English language. We then design all of our tasks so that the language requirements are very, very minimal. So for example, in understanding the children's brand knowledge in this most recent study, we didn't ask them, so what's your favorite brand? Because they don't know the B word. They don't know what a brand is. Instead, we laid out sheets of paper on the table in front of them. We gave them picture cards and we asked them to sort them into, we would put down the McDonald's logo and say, this one's a McDonald's, going to be a McDonald's picture. And then we put down the Burger King logo on another sheet of paper and we would say, this is going to be for things that are all Burger King. And then we put something random like a bunny rabbit on the last sheet of paper and we'd say, and this is going to be other things. So not McDonald's or Burger King, but other things go over here. And then we would give the child a deck of picture cards of things that belonged either to McDonald's or Burger King or didn't belong, and they would sort them out. So in doing that, they didn't have to speak to us, but we could get at, okay, do they understand what is McDonald's and what is Burger King? And are they able to sort out other things that are similar, like a KFC bucket of chicken or a piece of broccoli? Those are food. One of them's fast food, but those are not part of the McDonald's brand or the Burger King brand.
So inevitably, when studies like this come out, people either say, well, we need to, you know, ban unhealthy food advertising, and the people who don't think you should do that say, well, you need to limit your child's exposure to TV. I mean, I know it's kind of impossible to weigh in on this, but do you have any thoughts about, you know, is there something else between that eternal deadlock between get rid of all the ads and don't let your child watch TV?
Yeah, call me a fence sitter if you like, but my opinion is somewhere right down the middle. I am not someone, despite what my research findings show, I do not advocate for an outright ban on advertising to kids, nor would I recommend that parents necessarily try to restrict all advertising. Because if you cut your child off from the world, can you imagine their first week of college? Right? They're going to go crazy with junk food and not know.
Yeah, see the envy thing we were talking about earlier. Yeah.
Right. So instead, I think part of what we need is education, both for parents and for children, and also to create an awareness so that parents know how their children are being targeted, and that gives them the option. Okay. So then parents can choose, do I want to let my kids see this? Should I sit down and have a conversation with my child about it? Maybe they make a decision that they'll restrict TV until a particular age, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But in working with children and their parents for the last decade, what I found is that so many parents are not up to date on and can't keep up with knowing what the current marketing practices are. They don't realize just how much product placement is in TV shows and movies. they don't realize exactly what's happening when their child goes online and plays an advert game. They can think it's nice that their kid gets access to a free game online, and a lot of parents aren't really realizing that that's a lot of constant exposure to the brand logos and so on.
So in some ways, it's a matter of giving the parents tools to see that where advertising is that they might not think it is.
Right, absolutely. I often refer to it as leveling the playing field. You know, the marketers, often they're hiring psychologists. They want to get inside kids' heads. They've got all of the money and the power and the insights to do that. And I like for parents to have some insights into exactly what's going on. And then they can choose. They can choose then.
Dr. Anna McAllister, thank you so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Healthy, local, sustainable. Those words capture the priorities of the program Gourmet Gone Wild. Gourmet Gone Wild is a nonprofit program with a dual mission. First, it's about connecting 20 to 40-year-olds in mid-Michigan to the pleasures of hunting and fishing. Second, it's dedicated to promoting the benefits of eating healthy, locally harvested wild game. Several other entities are involved in Gourmet Gone Wild, including the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, Michigan State University, and others. And to learn more about Gourmet Gone Wild, we welcome Jordan Burroughs. Jordan's a wildlife outreach specialist at Michigan State University's Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
We're happy to have you. What is your role in Gourmet Gone Wild?
Well, I helped create the Gourmet Gone Wild program with Aaron McDonough of Michigan United Conservation Clubs. And with all the popular media looking at local and healthy and sustainable, we wanted to use those ideas as a springboard to introduce people to hunting and conservation through food.
Okay. So part of the mission is to expose 20 to 40-year-olds to hunting. How do you do that?
Well,
exactly?
Great question. What we do is we go to young professional organizations. So this demographic of the 20 to 40-year-olds and why we chose that, let me back up and start with that first.
That's my next question.
Okay.
But you're allowed to answer it now.
Basically, that's a generation that we feel is interested in, and many are interested in the local food, the fresh food. They want to know how food is produced, where it came from. They're interested in supporting their local economy. They have a concern for the environment. And this connection to food and hunting and wild game seems to be right up their alley. In addition, and from a conservation community, we do a lot of talking and educating youth, youth of either hunters, youth to get into hunting in the sport, in the passion of hunting, as well as current hunters. But we've really missed that middle demographic, that 20 to 40-year-olds that maybe didn't grow up hunting, that aren't part of a hunting family. So using this local, healthy, sustainable food as the connection into hunting. So guess what? You can go out and procure, harvest your own wild fish or game here in Michigan, right in your own backyard. It's antibiotic free, it's local, it's hormone free, and it lived an entire natural life. And those are things that a lot of this age demographic are interested in when they go to the grocery store.
Mm-hmm. So you go to these young professional groups or organizations and you offer what?
We offer what is a Gourmet Gone Wild program, which is about a two-hour event where we bring in a professional chef from Eagle Eye Country Club here in East Lansing, Chef Dan Nelson, where we bring in a handful of entrees for folks to try that are all wild fish or game dishes. We pair that with our amazing local beer and wine that we have here in Michigan, and we also do a cooking demonstration of how one of the dishes that they're eating, how that's prepared. So Chef Dan prepares one of the entree items that they're eating, and folks have an opportunity to sample that. As well as we talk a lot about why hunting, fishing, and conservation are so important, how it's local, how it's healthy, and how it's sustainable.
Now, wild game is, as you've pointed out, generally pretty healthy. Tell us more about that. I mean, there aren't many couch surfing squirrels out there that I know of. So, I mean, they tend to be non-sedentary.
Yes.
In general. Is that part of it?
Well, actually, there's many, many opportunities in terms of the healthy aspect. We have the healthy, just the physical activity of getting into the outdoors. As we know, spending time in nature rejuvenates your mental health. It reduces stress and increases your fitness levels, as well as just spending time with your family and friends in the outdoors. From a healthy perspective, nutritional health, it's, you know, the ultimate free-range food. It's free of growth hormones, antibiotics, and it lives in its entire life out in the wild. Technically, it's sometimes higher in omega-3 fatty acids, as well as it's often leaner, and it has sometimes a higher protein content and fewer calories.
Now, you are offering a relatively new class here as well, and this is interesting because there aren't many cooking classes that begin by showing you how to tie a fishing line. Here, tell us about the class you're offering.
We offered a cooking class where we taught people how to prepare a fish. In the past, we've also done, as part of Gourmet Gone Wild, we have Gourmet Gone Wilder. So not only have we embarked on teaching cooking classes, we also take people to the archery range and teach them how to shoot archery. We've taken them to the shooting range and taught people how to shoot a firearm. Some folks had never shot a firearm before, and this was their very first time. We've even taken people out into the field to try catching their own fish, showing them how not only to tie their line, how to cast a fly rod. In addition to, we've gone pheasant hunting. So we have that initial interaction where people maybe get to sample wild game for the first time, and then we have follow-up events from cooking classes to what we called Gourmet Gone Wilder, where we take them into the field or the stream and teach them how to fish or hunt.
Interesting. And do you go very far afield here from the Lansing area, or is there a statewide footprint to this program?
There is. We actually right now partner with young professional organizations across the state. We're looking in the future to expand to a variety of other demographics and groups of folks across the state. But yes, when we have our events, we try to make sure that they're centered around the area where the young professional organization is.
Is. Okay, very good. Jordan Burrows is our guest. Jordan's a wildlife outreach specialist at Michigan State University's Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, but she's also involved in a nonprofit program called Gourmet Gone Wild, and that's really what we're talking about here today. Do you encounter many just 100% novices in this thing? I mean, people who have never gotten anywhere near hunting or fishing?
We do. And that's exciting for me because I started out not hunting or fishing either. I didn't learn how to hunt or fish until I was in my 20s.
And now I do both.
And I think that aspect, I have a unique perspective in terms of not growing up in a family that hunted and fished and began to learn when I was in my 20s.
So, well, you're actually going after people a lot like yourself.
Exactly
then.
Right. So, exactly. Kind of opening their eyes to the amazing natural resources we have here in Michigan. A lot of folks don't realize we have 11,000 inland lakes, 36,000 miles of rivers, 3,000 miles of freshwater shoreline, and oodles of trails for folks to walk on, and you're never more than 6 miles away from a river or water
that's
body.
That's very interesting. Interesting stat about Michigan. Are you more often involved with hunters or fishers?
Both. We enjoy both.
It's about the same.
It's about the same. Exactly right. We've actually had the benefit of having grants to help support the program. So we received grants from the Hal and Jean Glasson Foundation, as well as the Great Lakes Fishery Trust to focus on the fishery side of things, and the National Shooting Sports Foundation to focus on the hunting side of things.
In Capital Gains, I know Capital Gains just ran an article about your organization and the cooking class. They wrote that this 20 to 40-year-old age group, quote, got kind of lost. How do you think that happened?
Well, I think that organization, or that cohort, that 20 to 40-year-olds, I believe that a lot of maybe their parents or grandparents grew up hunting, and I think in my perspective, with a lot of the organized sports and the other opportunities, electronics and whatnot, that this group maybe grew up with, they weren't connected with the outdoors, the whole child left inside phenomenon that Richard Louv talks about, that maybe they didn't have a chance to learn about hunting and fishing, or maybe they did when they were younger, but other priorities have come in the way. And so our opportunity right now is to connect with them and hope that we incite excitement and the desire to learn, as well as that they, when they do start having children, if and when they do have children, they will instill that desire to hunt fish or to be a conservationist in those children. So not only are we introducing those potential parents, but hopefully in the future they will introduce their children.
In history, we have had to be concerned about the fish that we catch. I mean, in the past, mercury has been a concern. Is that that is arguably less of a concern today than it used to be?
Well, that's a great question, and we do get that question from some of the folks that we interact with. And a lot of it has to do with the way you prepare the fish in terms of what if you're taking off some of the belly fat or how you're, if you're deep frying it or sauteing it, that can actually lessen the effects of contaminants in that you're eating.
So, oh, interesting. So you address that. This is a group effort. Who besides MUCC and Michigan State University are involved here?
The Michigan Department of Natural Resources is another partner, as is the Boone and Crockett Club. The Boone and Crockett Club is the oldest conservation organization in the nation, and one of their pillars, in addition to the idea of scoring big animals, how they, for their record system, they're also very interested in education and helping talk to people about conservation.
How many of the Boone and Crockett Club? I never heard about that until I was preparing for this segment. Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, mm-hmm. obviously. How many events, outreach type events, do you have in a typical year?
In a typical year, we have usually about 10 or so. And in the program's been going on for the last couple of years, and we've had about 20 young professional events, and we've reached probably around 750 people in just the last 2 years.
Do you feel like you're creating real disciples for the outdoors?
I think we're opening people's eyes to the opportunities that the outdoors provide, as well as hopefully opening their eyes to the benefits of hunting, fishing, and conservation. You know, folks that go through the Gourmet Gone Wild program may never become hunters or anglers, and that's okay. We would like some of them to become hunters and anglers. But if they understand and appreciate why people hunt and the many opportunities that are presented here in Michigan, then it's been a success.
Gourmet Gone Wild is the program. Our guest has been Jordan Burrows, who's involved in Gourmet Gone Wild. She's also a wildlife outreach specialist here at Michigan State in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. Good luck, Jordan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll preview the upcoming Michigan Shakespeare Festival. And for Neighbors in Action, we'll feature an organization that tries to ease the transition for some of MSU's international students by fostering local friendships. That and more Wednesday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and Aaron Young for engineering. Thanks Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.